and seminars, and we'll be talking more with them later. They just troubleshoot and do a lot for us in the back, and that's a really strong team. I'm your MC for this special series. I'm Trent Tigerstrom, the Associate Specialist with the Department of Ag Resource Economics at the University of Arizona. And in keeping in conjunction with our mission here at the Ag Uncertain Times of helping producers and others kind of meet the challenges of today's uncertain, we're going to talk today about just an overview of recent tax law changes and the current tax issues that are going on in light of what the Congress did with their late passing of several of the issues that came about. In order to do this, we have two great speakers today. Dr. Ruby Ward, the Associate Professor and Extension Specialist at Utah State University, and Gary Hoff at the University of Illinois, the Extension Specialist in Farm Accounting and Taxation. Now, a lot of what they're going to be talking about, you'll also be able to find what their presentations, what they're going to be covering, as well as a lot of other topics on this Rural Taxation Education website, or ruraltax.org is a good site. And a lot of people behind this team here are these individuals from across the United States. Written a lot of articles and other information that will be available. Again, that's at the ruraltax.org site. And we'll hear more about that after Ruby's talk at near the end. As we're going through this, we'd ask you that if you have any questions, you go ahead and type it in down there at the bottom where it says to ask a question, and then when you're done, you just click on that, and that will pop the question over in that question and answer box to where we'll either the team will be able to respond, or after we're done with each presentation, we'll ask two or three questions to each individual, and we'll be able to get some of the questions answered in, and then at the very end, we'll be able to ask a few more questions. If you want to know about the past websites or links to the past webinar series we've done, as well as the ones that we're doing today's webinar, all recordings will be available at this site. And it's at the Ag and Uncertain Times website. And you can either type in that URL or you can just do a Google search for Ag and Uncertain Times, and it should pop up for you. So like I said, all the information is available there, from past webinars as well as the one today and recordings and so forth. We also have a couple of upcoming webinars in Spanish. And one will be Dr. Roberta Cook. As you can see, we'll be talking about trends and dynamics in the fruit and vegetable markets, food safety rule implications. And then on March 7th, we'll have Dr. Kenda Curtis at Utah State University and Dr. Karina Garillo, she'll be talking about direct marketing options and risk management in fruit and vegetable production. And again, this with the food safety rule and implications. Another good site that you'd be able to get some additional information on is this Managing in Tough Times, or the MITNET extension.org site. There's a lot of resources there on risk management and other marketing issues and legal issues, and it's a good resource for a lot of additional information and looking at managing and tackling the management issues with your operation. If you're having trouble seeing some of the screens, you'll be able to hit the full screen up on the top bar there, and that will make the presentations larger on your screen without affecting anyone else, so you'd be able to click there and get a better view of the slides and the presentation. So at this time, what we'd like to do is we'd ask a few questions from the audience. Gives us a good indicator of where individuals are that are on this current webinar. Also gives our producer or presenters a chance to see where individuals are from, kind of what their audience is. So if you take some time, please, all you have to do is just click on the region of where you're at, or just tell us about yourself, kind of your primary occupation, so we get an idea of what the audience will be. We're going to ask basically three questions on the pod, and then we'll just jump right into the first presenter. So we'll move on to the question number two. And this is, what region of the country are you located in? The Southwestern, the Pacific Northwest, Intermountain. Just click where you're located. Again, it'll give us a good idea of what our audience is and where people are located. And wrapping up with the final question for this, at least this initial start, is including yourself, how many individuals are participating in this webinar from your location? This gives us a good indicator if there's more than one individual on the line or watching the viewing the webinar at any given time and location. Okay. I think that would do it, and I appreciate all the responses on that. And with this, we're going to move into our first presenter. We'll be moving things through. Our first presenter will be Gary J. Hoff. Gary grew up on a small grain and beef farm operation in western Ohio. Upon completing his bachelor's of science degree at Ohio State University, he began working for the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation in their farm records program. He later formed his own company in northeast Ohio, where he had farm accounting and taxation. During this time, he was also a seminar instructor for the National Association for Tax Professionals, making presentations in over 40 states. And then in 1987, he merged his firm with AgriSolutions Incorporated and became their national tax manager. Gary received his Enrolled Agents, or EA, a designation from the Internal Revenue Service, awarded a designation to tax professionals who successfully complete a two-day examination of all aspects of income tax. This designation then allows Gary to represent taxpayers in matters before the IRS, and to maintain this designation, he must meet annual continuing education requirements by the IRS. Gary began working for the University of Illinois Tax School in 2001. He's the editor of the Tax School Workbook, a 700-page workbook which is produced each year and used in continuing education classes for over 13,000 tax professionals. He also writes tax articles and conducts various seminars in each year. He's a member of the National Association of Enrolled Agents, National Association of Tax Professionals, and is the co-chair of the National Farm Income Tax Extension Committee, which meets with the IRS to assist with the publication 225, also known as the Farmer's Tax Guide. With that, I'll turn it over to Gary, and we'll be back on with a few questions.
Thank you, Trent. Welcome from a cold University of Illinois campus. I am Gary Huff, and I'll be discussing a few of the 2010 tax changes that affect agricultural producers. Some of the topics that I'll discuss include temporary extenders that came out of the bill. We'll talk a little bit about the gift tax, about estate taxes, some depreciation issues, the Section 179 direct expensing and bonus depreciation. We'll talk about some changes with 1099s, and then I'll end up with some self-employment health insurance, a big tax break that you'll have this year if you're self-employed. Obviously, there was a lot more in the bill, but we won't have time to get into all those details today. I want to look at the individual income tax rates. Individual tax rates will remain at 10, 15, 25, 28, 33, and 35% through 2012. Without the passage, the rates in 2011 and later years for an individual would have been 15, 28, 31, 36, and 39.6%. Note, the 10% rate still doesn't apply to trusts. The 2011 schedules for married filing separate and joint filers and surviving spouses also reflect the marriage penalty relief. While the extension of the tax rate schedule helps the higher income taxpayer, the highest percentage reduction is for the lower income taxpayer. The rate structure continues to be indexed for inflation. And you'll notice that from the slide that I have, while the dollar amount of savings isn't as great for low income, the percentage reduction is much higher than it is for the higher income tax brackets. You may have noticed an increase in the Dow Jones average. Part of this is because we now know the capital gain and dividend rate will remain at 0 and 15% for the next 2 years. Without the extension, the capital gain rate would have returned to 20% and dividends would have been taxed as ordinary income. The dividends must still be qualified dividends, and the stock must be held more than 60 days during the 121-day period beginning 60 days before the ex-dividend date. If you're considering selling capital gain assets, such as land, this is a good time to do it, as the rates could possibly increase in 2013. The earned income credit was greatly expanded by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act in 2009. It allows a maximum earned income for three or more children of $5,666. When earnings exceed $16,450, then the credit's reduced. If you're a cash basis farmer and have low profits in a year, you may be able to maximize your credit by prepaying expenses or deferring income. Obviously, you want to maximize profits every year, but this is a tip for those bad years. This increased earned income credit was extended through 2012. An individual, though, is not entitled to the earned income credit if their disallowed income exceeds $3,100. Disallowed income includes interest, dividends, rents and royalties, capital gains, and net passive income. One of the changes that came out of the Act, and this is major for you, is with the gift tax. Before 2004, the estate and gift tax rates were fully unified, means that the exemption amount and the rates were the same. Between 2004 and 2009, the same graduated rate was used, but the exemption amount for estate tax was higher than for gift tax. In 2009, the highest estate and gift tax rate was 45%, with a cumulative cap of $1 million on gifts before the estate tax rate was imposed. For gifts made in 2011, next year, and 2012, the gift tax exclusion is now $5 million, and it is indexed for inflation. However, it remains at $1 million for 2010 gifts. For 2010 and 2011, the $13,000 annual exclusion continues to apply. If the non-donor spouse agrees to split the gift, the annual amount's $26,000. These amounts are also indexed for inflation. There is an unlimited gift tax exclusion for gifts between spouses. However, the spouse must be a U.S. citizen. We've got some change in the estate taxes as well. Before passage of the Tax Relief Act, for deaths in 2010, there would have been no estate tax. However, the estate assets would have a carryover basis. This means the basis of the asset to the heirs would be the same as the basis was in the hands of the decedent. This means if you inherit a property from your father and he paid $19,000 for it in 1906, your basis would be $19,000, even though the current market value might be well over $1 million. The Tax Act also returned the stepped-up basis, and that can be a substantial tax saver for heirs. The basis in inherited property will be the fair market value of the property on the date of death. Therefore, they can now sell that inherited property with little or no income tax. In many cases, the carryover basis would be virtually impossible to calculate. Also, any inherited property is generally assumed to have met the one-year holding period for long-term capital gains. The Relief Act also extends the filing date for taxpayers deducting after December 31, 2009. The extended date is now September 19th of 2011. Section 6166 is still in effect. This allows most estate taxes to be paid on an installment basis rather than 9 months after the date of death. The payment period may not exceed 10 years. However, more than 35% of the decedent's estate must be closely held business assets. If this requirement's met, the estate may pay interest only for the first 5 years, followed by 10 equal payments. Effectively, this gives the estate 15 years to pay the federal estate tax. The interest rate for the first $1.34 million is only 2%. A closely held business could be either a partnership, proprietorship, or corporation. However, partnerships or corporations must have less than 45 partners or shareholders. With the sunset of the old act, this would have decreased to 15 partners or members. For deaths after December 31st, 2012, the QFOBI deduction is reinstated. This can shield up to $1.3 million of qualified family-owned business interest from the estate tax. The state death tax credit will be restored for deaths after December 31st of 2012. However, the state death tax deduction is going to expire at the same time. The reduction of state taxes begin with the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001. That act provided that estate taxes would decline each year until they disappeared in 2011. If the law had not had a 2010 sunset date, it would never have passed Congress initially. Because of the 2010 sunset, the exclusion amount was to return to $1 million in 2011. The estate tax burden reduction took place over 9 years. However, it was to return in its entirety in 2011. As an offset to the revenue lost, a provision was inserted that in 2010, the basis of inherited assets would be the carryover basis of the decedent. The law does allow the executor of the estate to increase basis by $1.3 million if the estate goes to the spouse. The increase then can be up to $3 million. The increase, though, could not exceed the fair market value of the asset. The Relief Act that was passed in December made a major change in that federal estate tax. It raised the exemption amount to $5 million for deaths in 2010 through 2012, and it set the highest rate at 35%. If there was a death in 2010, the executor can choose between the old law or the new law, depending on which is most beneficial. However, this can be a problem for an executor of a large estate. Depending on the type of property going to each heir, when the heir plans to sell it, and the projected capital gain rates, what is best for one heir may not be best for the other. The executor should probably have a signed consent from each heir before making the election. If you look at the table on the screen, notice there in 2010, we're saying the exemption amount can be either $5 million or it can be zero, with a top rate of 35% or 0%. Once you make that election becomes irrevocable. Another change that is really beneficial to estates is the portability election. A couple can truly have a $10 million estate and not have any estate tax liability. This is because the unused exemption of the first to die transfers to the surviving spouse. This is illustrated there in the example on the slide. Let's assume that I have Thomas, and he dies with a $4 million estate. Therefore, his estate has an excess $1 million exemption. This transfers to his wife, Jane. She now has a $6 million exemption available. This is her $5 million plus the $1 million from Thomas. The portability, though, only applies to the unused exclusion amount of the last spouse. Therefore, taxpayers with multiple marriages cannot increase their exemption amount by more than the unused exemption of the last spouse. This is true even if a prior spouse had a greater unused exemption amount. This does require an irrevocable election made on the return of the first to die. This could eliminate the need for trust for couples with under a $10 million estate. Be aware, though, for these provisions to apply, both spouses must die in either 2011 or 2012. Even if the deceased spouse doesn't have a taxable estate, a return must be filed and the election attached. This could be a possible malpractice issue for an uninformed executor or for the attorney of the estate. Let's turn now to some depreciation areas. These were part of the investment incentives that were built into the Tax Relief Act. You're probably familiar with the Section 179 expensing election. This is where you can write off all or a large portion of your purchases and place a depreciating them. For 2010 and 2011, the maximum 179 deduction is $500,000, subject to the net income and total purchase limitations. For 2012, this was scheduled to return to $25,000 with a purchase limit of $200,000. The Relief Act, though, increased the 2010 limit to $125,000 and the purchase limit to $500,000. Both of these amounts are indexed for inflation. In 2013, the amounts will return to $25,000 and $200,000. The ability to amend returns for the 179 election was also extended to include years 2003 through 2012. We'll look now at bonus depreciation. Under the old law, taxpayers could deduct 50% of the cost of new assets purchased in 2008, 2009, and 2010. Even 2011 for certain longer-lived and transportation property. The asset, though, had to be 20-year property or less. If the taxpayer did not want the extra depreciation, he had to elect out on a class-by-class basis. The depreciation was allowed for both the regular tax and the alternative minimum tax, but not for purposes of computing earnings and profits. Corporations could elect to claim additional research and minimum tax credits in lieu of taking the bonus depreciation. Tax Relief Act not only extended the bonus depreciation, but it greatly expanded it. For new property placed in service after September 8, 2010, and before January 1, 2012, the bonus depreciation is equal to 100%. If the new property is acquired through a like-kind exchange, both the boot and the carryover basis of the relinquished property qualify for the 100% bonus. Taxpayers are cautioned to examine their state tax provisions before claiming the 100% depreciation. For instance, in Illinois, all of the 100% bonus depreciation is added to the federal AGI. But no current year deductions allowed for any regular depreciation on the asset. This is different than the 50% bonus depreciation, where the bonus was added back, but the regular depreciation was deducted to compute the state income tax. What I want to look at now is a comparison between the 100% bonus and the 179 deduction. The 100% bonus and 179 can be used for new property. However, the 100% bonus depreciation cannot be used for used property. Both the 100% and 179 apply to Section 1245 property and certain real property improvements. You're familiar with 1245, that's your machinery and equipment. But only the 100% bonus is allowed on 20-year property. 20-year property, farm buildings. That means if you put up a new farm building between September and 2012, you can write 100% of that off on your tax return. Be aware of state tax implications. The 100% depreciation will also allow you to create a net operating loss, while 179 will not. And if it's property that's acquired in a like-kind exchange, the 100% depreciation is allowed on the carryover basis or that remaining depreciation of that relinquished property. Now let's talk a little bit about the Making Work Pay Credit. That's what reduced the income tax withholdings for Americans in 2010. That wasn't extended. But it was replaced with a reduction in the employee's FICA withholdings. The Medicare rate, though, remains unchanged. For 2010 only, employers will only withhold 4.2% for FICA rather than the normal 6.2%. This will not require any adjustment on the 2011 Form 1040. A self-employed person also pays two employment taxes. One's the Old Age Survivors and Disability Insurance, or the OASDI, at a 12.4% rate, and the health insurance at 2.9%. For 2011, that OASDI rate was reduced to 10.4%. To be comparable with the employer-employee tax, the self-employed individual can deduct one-half of that tax, or 7.65%, from the Form 1040 when they compute their AGI. The deductions built into the tax calculation on Schedule SC when the self-employment income is multiplied by 0.9235. Under the new law, 59.6% of the OASDI tax replaces the 50% rate used prior to the Relief Act. This then allows the self-employed to be comparable to the employer-employee rate. Railroad employees under the railroad retirement system will also see a 2% cut. The 2% reduction, though, is not going to affect the money that goes into the Social Security Trust Fund. The law provided that an amount equal to the 2% reduction will now be taken out of general funds. If you're under a state or municipal retirement system, you're not going to see any benefit from this tax cut. Let's talk about 1099s. The cost of the health care bill is very high, so money has to be generated to pay for it. Because the IRS believes people do not report income unless a Form 1099 is sent to the government, the bill increases the filing of the 1099 forms. The new requirement is for aggregate purchases of $600 or more to a single payer. The difference is this includes both property and services. Under the old law, the 1099 was only required for services. In addition, payments to corporations are no longer exempt. Effective for years beginning after December 31st, 2011, is when this will take effect. And while we're on 1099s, the Small Business Job Act also mentioned 1099s. If you're a landlord and pay anyone over $600, you must now furnish a 1099. This provision is effective for payments made after 2010. So what did we do? We added both property and services. That means if you make purchases at a farm supply store, you'll have to do the 1099 if the aggregate exceeds $600. And if you're a landlord, and let's say you pay someone to mow down the grass and weeds on your CRP land, if that aggregates over $600, you'll also have to do a 1099. How do we enforce this? Part of the enforcement is through an increase in the 1099 reporting penalties. Effectively, they have gone through and doubled the amount of penalties that are there, and you can see those penalties on the screen. So it's no longer, well, I may not file, I'll simply wait until they catch me. Finally, the self-employed health insurance deduction. This is a one-year-only provision for tax years beginning after December 31st, 2009. So it's for the returns that you're filing now. The self-employed taxpayer can reduce their net self-employment income for the cost of their family health insurance. Therefore, that deduction will also reduce the self-employment tax. What we're showing here on this slide is a piece of the Form 1040. On the 1040 on line 29, you'll enter your self-employed health insurance deduction. It's not a part of the Schedule F. It's the same place as you reported in the past. But the bottom section shows a portion of the Schedule SC. That's where you pay your self-employment tax. And you'll enter on line 3 the amount of the family health insurance and consequently get the reduction. This has been extremely quick. I hope the information has been helpful, and I'll be happy to take any questions that you have.
Well, thank you, Gary. That was a good presentation, covered a lot of information, and we do have a couple of questions here. One of the first questions I see is, do the changes in the estate tax legislation code suggest producers review and or change their estate plan?
My opinion is you need to review your estate plan every couple of years. For example, if you've got under a $10 million estate for husband and wife, you may not need those trusts that were set up. However, Congress is going to come back, look at this again at the end of 2012. And whether they'll remain at $5 million a person, I don't know. So if you did away with those trusts, then you'd have to come back, put them back in effect. And again, I suggest to my clients that at least every couple of years, they take a look at them and see if they still make sense to minimize that estate tax.
Okay. Another question came in is, please discuss any sunset issues pertaining to the changes in the estate tax law, specifically since the new law goes out in 2013-2015, was Congress challenged to come up with a new estate tax legislation?
They're definitely going to have to come up with something because it's a sunset, and as a sunset, we would go back to the $1 million that's there, would go back to the higher estate tax rates. And I think it was in the interest of time that they did this two-year change. In fact, I think many of us were relatively surprised that they went to a $5 million level. No one ever thought we'd go to zero in 2010. We figured they would make changes before that. So we'll see what happens the next time we get through the election cycle.
All right, and one final question before we move on to the next one is, what would be the long-term consequences of Social Security benefits of reduced contributions by employed and self-employed, by employees and self-employed?
This reduction that they're having in the self-employment tax will have absolutely no effect on benefits that will be received at retirement. They're taking that money out of general funds. It was just easier for the IRS to go through and make this reduction rather than something like the Making Work Pay credit.
All right. Thank you very much, and very informative. And we're going to move on to our next speaker, and it's Dr. Ruby Ward. And Gary will be on the line later on at the end where we will do a wrap-up session with both speakers. Dr. Ruby Ward was raised on a farm and ranch in southeast Idaho. After graduating from Ricks College, she received a bachelor's in agricultural economics and accounting from Utah State University. Continued her education at Texas A&M University, where she received an MBA and a PhD in agricultural economics. Dr. Ward joined the faculty at Utah State University in 1998 and was tenured in 2005. Ruby is currently associate professor and extension specialist at Utah State University in the Department of Applied Economics. Her current assignment involves all three areas emphasized at a land-grant university. These include teaching, research, and extension. She currently teaches agricultural finance and community planning. Ruby is also the committee chair for the Diversified Agricultural Conference, held in her state every year. Ruby is also project leader of the Rural Tax Education website I mentioned earlier. She's also the co-chair of the National Farm Income Tax Extension Committee. Ruby works primarily in the areas of rural development, focusing on regional economics and agricultural entrepreneurship. And she's going to continue our discussion with agricultural tax issues and going into a little more looking at the cash flow depreciation and how that affects the cash flow.
All right. I think I've got the power now. So I'm going to jump right into it because we don't have a lot of time. Trent mentioned the ruraltax.org website, and so a lot of the materials that you've seen here, and I'll be going over, you can find more details at ruraltax.org. That's the URL for the website. Some of those include the new depreciation rules, cash flow issues that I'm going to talk about. Those actually won't be posted until the end of the week. They're going through an editorial review. some information about hobby loss rules, and some 1099 information. So that's just another place you can go after this webinar. So first of all, the new depreciation rules and cash flow. Part of it is going to talk about the tax law issues, but also what it can do to your financial risk. So the new depreciation rules that Gary went over, the 100% of the asset you can deduct in the year it's purchased. You can elect to use regular depreciation instead. There's no limit, and it has to be purchased after September 8th. Section 179, in contrast, is for new and used and deduct up to $500,000 of qualifying assets. I went over that quick because Gary's already covered it. The things that I want to talk about, though, are that depreciation rules do not increase overall deductions. All they do is they move them from an earlier year or move them to an earlier year, and so you have fewer deductions in later years, more in earlier years. Another thing to remember is that the principal part of a loan payment is paid with after-tax dollars. Principal is not tax deductible, and so therefore you need after-tax dollars to pay it. If you have less deductions, you're going to need more revenue to pay for that taxes and then to have enough left over to cover principal payments. So let's get into an example, and here's where those things will probably come to light. So we buy a $30,000 truck. If we deduct all of it in the year that he buys it, that may result in $11,000 in savings on his 2011 income and self-employment taxes. And the dealer is offered to accept zero down and finance the purchase over 4 years using a 2.9% interest rate. So should he buy the truck? The payment would be $8,000 each year and a marginal tax rate of 35%. The reason I'm using that is because we'd have effectively a 15% self-employment tax plus a 15% federal tax and then a 5% state tax rate. Gary talked about the self-employment tax rate would be 2% smaller for this year, but I just kept it at the rates that we'd have it over time. So here, looking at the numbers, you can see the loan payment up here at the top. We have the interest and the principal, and all those each year are going to add up to the total loan payment. And I've also shown two options for depreciating the truck. One is to use maker's depreciation, which is our normal depreciation. Maker stands for Modified Accelerated Cost Recovery System. And it's just the normal depreciation rates we'd use. And so here we'd put $4,500 in the first year, $7,000, and then it would get a little bit lower over time, but eventually we've depreciated the full $30,000. The tax savings associated with that, in the first year we have $1,575 of tax savings, but we have no payment on the truck, so we'd actually get a savings. In later years, the tax savings get smaller as depreciation gets smaller. And I'll show you how I calculated this a little bit later, but the bottom line is in those later years when we have to make a payment on the truck, you need $7,800 worth of revenue in 2012 in order to, after you make that depreciation deduction, in order to have enough after-tax revenue to pay your principal payment. So this is where we look at the financial risk associated with it and not just the tax treatment, because this is showing how much revenue you're going to need and what the requirements are of how many, you can put this into terms of how many additional hay bales you need to sell, calves, bushels of barley, wheat, whatever you want to do. But this puts it into more of a context of what it's really going to take to pay for it in the future. The other deed option is to depreciate the entire amount of the truck during the first year, take a $30,000 worth of depreciation. And in this case, this could be done with the special depreciation allowance or a Section 179 deduction. And we get tax savings of $10,500. So assuming you have other positive income, you could take that $30,000 against, you would actually save $10,000 on your taxes in 2011. And in future years, you'll see that there's not a lot of tax savings. We get a little bit because our interest is tax deductible. But is what I want you to really notice is here, under this scenario, we're going to need almost $12,000 of revenue each year to service the debt, where up here, when we use the regular depreciation, it needed less. And so because we put more depreciation, more deductions into future years, there weren't as many available for later years, and so that's going to result in more revenue needed to just service the debt. And so from a financial risk standpoint, $11,900 is bigger than $7,800, and so taking the entire cost up front may make you more at risk from a financial perspective. But every situation is different, so you really need to kind of look at your own situation. So here's how I came up with those numbers. In the first year that we'd be paying for it, if you had $7,800 of revenue, you'd make a loan payment of $8,000. You'd save $2,500 on income taxes because of the depreciation and the interest deduction. And that would give us a net cash outflow of $7,800 and a net cash flow of zero. In the first year, when all we have is a savings on income taxes, then it would just give us a positive $1,575 back. So you can kind of just see where those numbers came from. And so, and then I want to, so this is coming back to the same slide that you saw before, again with these numbers here. One thing that I didn't point out, though, is if you have positive income in these years, you would actually have, you could have like negative revenue and still be at the same spot because of the tax savings. And so I'm going to put those in now. And as you do this, you see that your total revenue needed over here for both scenarios is the same. If you have that positive income from some other source to allow you to actually save this much money on your taxes. And so I think that there's a misconception out there that we have this really aggressive depreciation rule that we can save a lot of money on our taxes. And the bottom line is that it doesn't save money on taxes. It only shifts deductions between years. And so this one here, it shifts more deductions in the first year, which leaves fewer less, and so there's more financial risk in these later years because more revenue is needed. And while this doesn't look like a lot of difference, you've only got around $3,000 or $4,000 difference, if you did this multiple years after years, year after year on multiple assets, then that would start to build up. And if we start looking at doing this with tractors and writing off the full tractor or a $250,000 grain combine or something like that, you'd see much more dramatic differences. But the lesson's still the same, that if you take all that depreciation up front, you'll probably have more financial risk and need more revenue in later years to cash flow. So just some things to think about. For new assets, the special depreciation allows you to deduct 100% in the year you purchase it, but you can elect to use the regular depreciation instead. There's no limit, and it has to be purchased by the end of 2011. This is only for new assets, but Section 179 is new and used, but it does have a limit. Special depreciation can be used on the 20-year property with buildings. The thing, though, to remember is that it must be used for all assets, all new assets purchased in that property class. So if you want to use it for some 20-year property, you have to use it for all 20-year property, where a Section 179 deduction can be used on a single asset or even part of an asset. And so there's differences in these and how you would apply them, and so you really need to kind of look at your situation. And just kind of the bottom line, it doesn't eliminate taxes. It only shifts it. But there still may be reasons to use it. A producer may use it to keep out of a higher tax bracket, especially in a higher income year. More of the equipment is purchased with cash, and so this makes sense to match that depreciation up. And there may be some other individual reasons. I think this is like any other tool. It can help you if used with caution, but it has the ability to hurt a producer also. Okay, that was a quick run of depreciation. Since this is ag and uncertain times, I thought one thing that may be coming to people's minds is when do Hobby Loss rules kick in? If, and Hobby Loss rules are that if an operation is deemed to be not for profit, then you're not able to deduct losses greater than your revenue. And so to be able to deduct expenses greater than receipts, farmers must be engaged in a business for profit. And so this is what, whether you're, and if you're not engaged in business for profit, then you would be a hobby. Profits, of course, revenue minus expenses. And the IRS, first of all, has the first rule that says if it's not a hobby, if profits are made in 3 out of 5 consecutive years, for equine operations, that's 2 out of 7 years. And if the profit test isn't met, that only allows the IRS, if they want to look into it. It is not automatically, say the IRS is going to look at it and it doesn't automatically say that the operation is a hobby. It just opens you up to that scrutiny. If the IRS chooses to look into the situation because the profit test hasn't been met, then they have 9 guidelines that they use to determine if a business or it's a hobby. And these include if the business is carried out in a business-like manner, you keep track of receipts and expenses, there's a separate checking account. Another one is if additional knowledge and education is being pursued. This webinar would be one of those things. Expertise of the producer, time and effort spent. And again, there's a fact sheet on this issue on the RuralTax.org website. You can go there for more information. But that's just a little bit on the hobby loss rules. We also have Form 1099. Gary mentioned that there's a new provision that would say rather than just doing it on services, that we would have 1099s on both property and services. And so I just was going to go over a few details of what the current 1099 situation is. And again, there's a fact sheet on RuralTax.org. So Form 1099 miscellaneous income is required for payments of $600 or more for rents and services or payments of at least $10 in royalties. And this is cumulative for the entire year. And so we're not looking at a single payment, but really how, if you've paid to one person more than $600 over the course of the year for services, then you'd need to issue them a 1099. There's a 1099 interest income that also can be filled out. So payments not subject to 1099s currently, payments other than medical and health care made to a corporation. So if you made it to a corporation, you don't have to pay a 1099. Sorry. Payments for merchandise don't require 1099. And that's the big change that the IRS is looking at. Payments to rent to real estate agents. The payments to rent for other people, for non-real estate agents, may require 1099. And to some of the others, you can read these. So, sorry. So here's some situations. $4,000 herbicide purchase. You don't need a 1099 because that's a product. $1,200 to Luke Carefully, a certified crop consultant. You'd need, that's for a service, it's more than $600. You'd need a 1099. $1,100 for soil testing to Cropmaster Inc. That is a corporation, so it doesn't require a 1099. $500 to a neighbor to plow. That does require, that doesn't require a 1099 because it's under $600, but it is for a service to a non-corporation. $750 paid to the neighbor's LLC to haul grain. That's for freight, so we don't need one. $5,000 cash rent to Sally's sister. That's over $600, so we need it. $25 interest payment on installment purchase of land. That would require the 1099 interest form. And $1,000 paid to Brad Handy for services and supplies to fix the shed. That does require one because we don't have a way of determining what was for services and what was for supplies. And it was over $600 to an individual, so we require 1099. And so what Gary was talking about, the change would be that we would now require 1099s for anybody that was a non-corporation that you've paid over $600 to. So here's an example. Sally paid $600 for performing custom services as a non-employee. She receives a 1099 miscellaneous and reports the income on Schedule F. Sally receives cash rent of $3,000 from a farmer. She receives a 1099 miscellaneous and reports the income on Schedule E. Sally purchased some supplies and marketed income, Sally purchased some supplies and marketed some products through her co-op. She receives $800 in patronage dividends that consist of $160 in cash and $640 in qualified written notice of allocation. She's going to receive the 1099 PATR, and that's going to show $800, and she'll report that on Schedule F. Ag program payment. Sometimes you're involved in a partnership or a group that'll get a program payment, and it'll all be sent to one person using their Social Security number. So in this case, Sally receives the Thorne 1099-G for $24,000, but $8,000 of that was for her partner, Rich Smith. Sorry. She's going to report the $24,000 on Schedule F, 6A, and $16,000 on Line 6B. So only the $16,000 will be taxable. She's going to also have to issue to Rich a 1099-G for the remaining $8,000, and then Rich would show that $8,000 on his Schedule F. Another problem, sometimes this comes up, is when Dustin is the president of an irrigation association, and so Dustin, rather than the association, was listed as the subsidy recipient for an EQIP payment, and so Dustin receives that 1099 from the USDA for the full amount. Dustin's going to have to issue 1099s to each member for their amount, and then the net effect would be that Dustin's only going to have as taxable income on his return the net amount that he actually received. So that was all that I had on 1099s. I just thought, or Gary brought that up, that it'd be good to go over them a little bit. This and other information is available on ruraltax.org. One of the things that we have there is a sample tax return, and rather than just a Schedule F, it's got explanations and the forms for all the different forms that you'd find your farm income on, and that's available if you click on sample tax return once you get to the website. Another thing that's there are tax topics. These are fact sheets, and I went over a little bit of the 1099 information. Gary mentioned self-employment tax. This applies to give you a little bit more information on that. Who's a farmer for different purposes? And the hobby loss rules, I went over it. There's more on here that we don't see on the screen, but that's another source of help. These are links that are on the website. Gary's in charge of that University of Illinois Tax School, so that's his website. And there's some other places here. So I think that was everything that I have. So any questions? Sorry for my voice today and the coughing. It just kind of happened.
All right. Thank you, Ruby. There are a few questions coming in from the audience. And the first question I want to see is where you have elected out of the Section 263A and are required to use an alternative depreciation schedule, are you still precluded from using the bonus depreciation?
That's a little more technical than I know. Gary, do you have the answer to that?
If you've elected out of 263A, you can't use 200% declining balance. You have to use 150% declining balance, but I don't believe that precludes you from the bonus depreciation.
Okay, here's another one that we have from the audience. Is do we have to pay self-employment tax if the businesses show no profit?
No, you don't. However, because you're only paying that tax on your profit, and so I don't believe you have to file the self-employment tax form for under $400. I might have that wrong. However, there is an optional method for farming that allows you to actually pay self-employment tax on just enough income that it allows you to continue your quarters of coverage. So if something happens, you're still eligible because you've had those quarters of coverage recently.
Okay.
And what that does is protects your disability benefits.
Okay. All right, and another question came in, is that the $250 penalty for not filing a 1099, is there also a penalty for each 1099 you should have filed, or just a single $250 penalty?
No, it's a penalty on each, and it's a three-tier penalty. If you file like 30 days late, it's one. If you don't file by August 31st, it's second. A second tier higher. If you don't file at all, it's the highest tier. That highest tier can go up to an aggregate of like $1 million total penalty. So you can't afford to ignore it.
Okay, and then one final question, and that was, again, is related to the 1099, and is, what is the status of the 1099 requirement repeal in progress?
They are continuing to try to get it repealed, but every time it goes in front of Congress, it's voted down. I did hear that President Obama has now said that he's in favor of the repeal of it. Part of that's because there is so much information that they won't be able to use. For example, if I have to do a 1099 for a nationwide chain like Farm and Fleet or whoever, think of the millions of those that are going to come in. Those aren't the companies that aren't reporting income. So it's creating lots of work for the farmer with no benefit to the government.
Okay. Thank you very much to Ruby and Gary for their great presentations on some of the hot tax topics that are currently going on. And as Ruby mentioned, you can go either to the Ag in Uncertain Times and review these, the presentations, and look at them in a little more detail. And there's also the ruraltax.org site to give you a lot more in-depth information about these tax issues. And we'll move over to the next one as we're cleaning up today, wrapping things up, today's speakers. And next thing we're going to do, we have a few more questions for the audience. We'll just answer a couple of these, and then we'll be moving on. These are just kind of a cleanup, and it helps us try to get a better idea of what other issues are out there, what's your primary source of marketing information you look at, marketing and or tax information you would look at in this case, if you're looking at the universities or non-tax or banks, lendings, wherever it might be that you go for that. Next question we'd have is, what is your primary source of marketing information for this, or what is your prior to this seminar, how aware are you of the issues discussed today? So what we're looking at for is just kind of your take on the issues, how well you thought you were prepared or you knew the tax information and the changes in the tax law. Okay. We'll do one more here. Was this seminar worth your time? This gives us a good indication of folks how they felt about the quality and the information provided, and it gives us a lot more indication about where to go next and what improvements we can make to the next webinar series. And then I think this would be the kind of the final one we have here is this kind of a lengthy one. You can kind of read through it, but what is your greatest take-home point from today's seminar? You can look at those choices you have below and down at the bottom ones, D through F. You can do multiple choices, pick A and B or A, B, and C. It just gives you a lot more options. Okay. We'll move to the next and final question, or is that all the questions? Okay. What's the likelihood of preparing the next seminar? Will participate, not sure, or will not participate? It gives us an idea of what's going on. Again, it could be topic-specific, and we will also be sending out a link or a kind of a monkey survey looking at new topics or interesting topics that individuals might be willing to see. And if you do receive one of those, I'd really appreciate you taking the time to fill it out and send us back, because it really helps us kind of focus in on new targets that we can address. Okay. The next one we're going to go to is the next upcoming webinars we're going to have, as I mentioned earlier on, is Dr. Roberta Cook's going to talk about the trends and dynamic fruit and vegetable market, food safety rule implications. That's February 28th. And then on March 9th, we'll have Dr. Kenza Curtis and Dr. Katrina Carrillo, and they'll be doing a joint talk on the direct marketing options and risk management in fruit and vegetable production. Again, safety rule implications. These will be in Spanish, and that, again, they'll be in February 28th and March 7th, and that's at the regular time that most of our webinars occur. You can always go to the Ag and Uncertain Times website, and as I mentioned before, if you do not have the URL or did not come in an email, you can always do a Google search on Ag and Uncertain Times. And it's a great resource to find recordings of the webinars, presentations of set slides, and speakers, and contact information, as well as just kind of discussions on webinar topics. If your question wasn't answered here, it could be answered there. Okay. And again, like I mentioned before, these are used in the chat box, and we're also going to send out for future websites and future web topics. If you just want to be a part of that, you can send us an email at this westrme@wsu.edu, and you'll be on the list to be, and we'll make you aware of any upcoming information, and then you can also participate in providing feedback on additional topics. So if you can click on each of the file below and the highlights, and then you click on this, you can save your computer. This gives you kind of the webinar links and so forth. You can be able to download to directly to your computer, so you'll have that information at a future time, and be able to share that with the individuals. And with that, thank you for attending, and we look forward to seeing you next time. And for now, have a great day, and we will talk to you on our next webinar. Thank you. Hello?
Hi, are we off the air?
Yeah. Are you guys still there?
I'm still here.
Okay. So, any thoughts?